Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, January 12th, 2023. Candidate filing period for local city government school board positions opens soon. Art by Crow Crumbs by Mary Cantrell. Tri-County. The candidate filing period for available local city and school board positions, which will appear on the May 6th general election ballot, begins on January 18th and runs through February 17th with a filing deadline of 5 p.m. Early voting begins Monday, April 24th, and runs until Tuesday, May 2nd. In order to qualify to run, candidates must have resided in the respective city where the office is held for at least 6 months, must be 18 years of age or older, be a U.S. citizen, and must not have been convicted of a felony. A full list of qualifications can be found on the Secretary of State's website. The Big Bend Sentinel spoke to area municipalities and school districts to obtain the details on which positions will be up for election this May and how interested candidates can apply for public office. It is free to apply for local city and school board positions. Council members and mayors serve 2-year terms, while school board members serve 3-year terms. Presidio County, Marfa City Council. The role of the mayor of Marfa, currently held by Manny Baeza, will be up for election in May. Baeza was first elected as mayor in 2019, then ran unopposed, and was re-elected for a second term in 2021. Before becoming mayor, Baeza served as a city council member starting in 2008. Baeza told the Big Bend Sentinel he has yet to make a firm decision, but was currently leaning towards running again. The term of council member Irma Salgado, who has served on city council since 2017, will also be up. Salgado currently serves as mayor pro tem for city council, a position which is appointed by fellow council members once a new council is sworn in. Salgado said she will not be running for another term. The seat of former council member Jason Ballman, who tendered his resignation in the fall, will be up for election, as will the seat of council member Raul Lara. Lara said he plans to run to stay on council. Council members convene 2 times a month and are paid $50 per meeting. Interested parties may access applications in both English and Spanish online on the city's website closer to January 18th. Applications will also be available for pickup starting January 18th at City Hall. To submit applications, individuals may file in person at City Hall, mail their applications to City Hall at Post Office Box 787, Marfa, Texas, 79843, or email them to secretary@cityofmarfa.com. Marfa ISD School Board. The Marfa School Board will have 2 trustee positions up for election in May, Place 1 and Place 2. The board recently solicited letters of interest from the community in order to fill Place 1, which has remained vacant since the resignation of previous board member Krista Marquez in July. The trustees are set to discuss applications and whether or not to appoint someone to the seat at their next board meeting on January 16th. If the board chooses to appoint a new member, that individual will have to run for the seat, if opposed, in May, or may be appointed again at that time if running unopposed. Interested parties are encouraged to pick up an application packet at the district's administration building, located up the stairs next to Martin Field's Lincoln Street entrance. The school board is currently in discussions regarding whether or not to put a $57 million school bond initiative, which failed to pass the popular vote in November, on the ballot in May. If the board decides to put the bond up for a vote again, they will need to order the election by the February 17th deadline. Last May, the City of Marfa election, typically held in conjunction with the school board, was canceled due to a lack of candidates vying for the available seats. Presidio City Council. Presidio City Council will see the position of mayor, currently held by John Ferguson, up for election, as well as two council member seats. Ferguson has served as the mayor of Presidio since 2013. The seats of council members Ariane Velasquez Ornelas and Nancy Arevalo will be up. Starting January 18th, those interested in applying may visit City Secretary Brenda Ornelas at City Hall, 507 West O'Reilly Street, or email her at bornelas@presidiotx.us to pick up a packet. Applications will also be available in English and Spanish on the city's website. The City of Presidio will hold a joint election with the Presidio Independent School District in May. Voting will likely take place at the Presidio Activity Center, PAC, per Ornelas. Presidio ISD School Board. Over half of Presidio ISD's school board will be up for election, with the terms of Yvonne Spencer, Ethel Barriga, Hugo Ramos, and Fidel Baeza expiring in May. The superintendent's secretary, Elizabeth Melendez, will have application packets available online and for pickup at the administration building, 701 East Market Street, starting January 18th. Completed applications may be submitted via email to E3MELENDEZ@presidio-isd.net, in person at the administration office, and by mail to Presidio ISD, P.O. Box 1401, Presidio, Texas, 79845. Brewster County, Alpine City Council. Three Alpine City Council member seats will be up for election as the terms of Judy Stokes, Ward 1, Sarah Tandy, Ward 3, and Jerry Johnson, Ward 5, expire in May. All are serving their first terms as council members. Johnson also serves as mayor pro tem. Applications may be picked up in person at City Hall, 100 North 13th Street. Alpine ISD School Board. The Alpine ISD School Board will have two seats up for election in May. District 2, currently held by Joe Portillo, of no relation to the newly elected Presidio County Judge of the same name, and District 6, currently held by Dr. Adrian Billings. Portillo has served on the school board since 2019 and Billings since 2017. Alpine ISD has held school board elections in the recent past, with at least one contested race on the ballot. Interested parties are encouraged to visit the administration building, located at 704 West Sulross Avenue, to pick up an application from the superintendent secretary, Marsha Roach. Jeff Davis County, Valentine City Commission. Due to its size, the City of Valentine is run by a city commission rather than a city council. The city commission consists of the mayor, Summer Webb, and two city commissioners, Laurel Conilio and Danny Garcia. This May, the term of Garcia will be up. The mayoral seat will be up for election next year in May 2024. According to the city clerk, Albert Miller, Valentine has not held an election in years, as candidates have run unopposed. But if an election is held, it will be in conjunction with Valentine ISD. Interested parties may contact Miller at the city in order to apply. 432-386-3437. Valentine ISD School Board. The Valentine ISD School Board will have two seats opening up in the upcoming school board election. A seat held by Clay Webb and a seat which is currently vacant will be up for election. Applications for a place on the ballot can be picked up and returned to Secretary Sylvia Lopez at Valentine Elementary School Monday through Friday between 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. Saguaro Connector Pipeline to carry natural gas to border for export under a federal review. A map showing the path of the proposed Saguaro Connector Pipeline, with a red star marking the location of the border facilities at the pipeline's end point, currently under federal review. Image courtesy of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. By Allegra Hobbs. Far West Texas, a pipeline that could transport 2.834 billion standard cubic feet of natural gas per day, beginning in the Permian Basin and crossing the border of Mexico at Hudspeth County, is currently under review. Saguaro Connector Pipeline, LLC, a subsidiary of One Oak, O-N-E-O-K, Incorporated, in December, submitted an application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, for a permit to construct facilities to transport natural gas across the border from Hudspeth County into New Mexico, where it would then be transferred to a planned natural gas export facility on the west coast of Mexico. Though the pipeline under federal review would connect to a much larger natural gas pipeline planned to snake through West Texas, the application process only applies to the relatively small portion that meets the border. The two-part application seeks a FERC authorization and a presidential permit to construct and maintain the border facilities, which would cover roughly 1,000 feet of 48-inch diameter pipeline beneath the Rio Grande. Per the application, the facilities would cost $9,500,000 to construct and affect approximately 35.5 acres of land. Landowners affected by the project under FERC jurisdiction have been notified of the project by Saguaro via introduction letters, the application says. A list of affected landowners has not been made public and is labeled privileged information. But the rest of the planned pipeline, to which the border facilities would connect, are intrastate, falling entirely within the state of Texas, thus falling under the jurisdiction of the Texas Railroad Commission, and do not require approval or permitting from the federal government. That intrastate pipeline will span 155 miles, transporting natural gas from the Waha Hub in Pecos County to the border. Along the way, it would go through Reeves, Jeff Davis, Culberson, and Hudspeth counties. As it nears the border, it will be in proximity to the historic Indian Hot Springs site. Locals are already raising ecological concerns and concerns regarding archaeological sites near the pipeline's path. Local archaeologist David Keller noted the pipeline would pass near some undisturbed archaeological sites in Hudspeth County. Archaeological sites are ubiquitous all over the place, he said. There's no way you can do that much ground disturbance without disrupting some sites. These projects do a lot of damage ecologically and to cultural sites, he continued. Independent researcher Coyen Gibson, who monitors seismic activity in his home county of Reeves, expressed concern about the pipeline's path through an area that has recently seen an alarming jump in seismic activity. Beyond that, he expressed concern about its path through sparsely populated territory with few first responders, which he saw as a public safety matter. This is a high-pressure transmission line spanning some of the least populated, poorest counties in Texas, he said. Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at advocacy group Public Citizen, says he has concerns about the project and has already intervened in the proceedings to make his concerns known. Public Citizen's concerns have to do with the impact of exporting natural gas on domestic energy markets, Slocum explained. We're going to be saying to the FERC, you need to examine the market impacts that moving this volume of gas out of the United States and into international markets is going to have, he said. The end result of the pipeline is to be the exporting of natural gas out of Mexico, he said, participating in the global natural gas market. On those grounds, Slocum questioned the application's claim that the pipeline was in the public interest because it is exporting natural gas to Mexico, a country with which the U.S. has a free trade agreement. I don't know how courts will view that or how FERC will view that, but I plan on challenging this designation as they're basically saying this pipeline is automatically in the public interest because we're exporting to a country with whom we have a free trade agreement, he said. The fact the gas will afterwards be exported out of Mexico calls that claim into question, he argued. But the portion of the pipeline under federal review and open to public comment is only that which meets the border, the 1,000 feet for which Saguaro is seeking approval. FERC has set a deadline of January 26th at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to submit motions to intervene. That information can be found at https://elibrary.fercy.gov/elibrary/file list?question mark accession_num=202031050520. The application can be read in its entirety via the FERC website at https://elibrary.ferc.gov/elibrary/file list?number=202212020-5286. If all goes according to plan per the application, Saguaro hopes to receive approval from FERC in 2023 and to begin construction in 2024, with plans for it to become operational in 2025. Presidio City officials tackle Transmigrante traffic congestion by Sam Karras. Presidio. As traffic at the Presidio Port of Entry ramped up during the holiday season, there were a number of close calls as vehicles attempting to enter Mexico and vehicles headed on U.S. 67 toward Marfa tried to maneuver around large trains of Transmigrante vehicles staged on the shoulder. Mayor John Ferguson took to social media to field citizen concerns. If you see these long lines in Presidio, please drive carefully, he wrote. Transmigrante traffic, part of a special program that allows passage through Mexico for merchants selling used cars and other goods in Central America, has grown since the program was implemented in 2021. Big Bend locals may recognize the Transmigrantes on the highway as passenger vehicles towing other passenger vehicles, often hauling used appliances and tools as well. With that growth, Presidio City officials have tried to navigate the unique challenges of playing host to the long trains of vehicles processed through the port. The traffic issue is emblematic of larger communication issues that have sprouted up between the City of Presidio, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, TxDOT, and the Mexican officials responsible for issuing individual permits to the transmigrantes. Before the program came to Presidio, the only port designated for transmigrante traffic was Los Indios, just upstream from Brownsville on the Texas side and Matamoros on the Mexican side. Routing some of that traffic through Presidio and Ojinaga was touted as a way for truckers to avoid violence and unrest in the state of Tamaulipas, but Presidio city officials say they weren't involved in the process of selecting the alternate route. "This sort of just landed in our laps," Ferguson said. When the program was first implemented, customs officials on the American side set basic guidelines for how they would handle each vehicle's crossing into Mexico. They limit crossings between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., Monday through Friday, and ask individual brokers to send units of around 10 at a time. "The staging area is not really controlled by us," explained Roger Mayer, a spokesperson for CBP. "The way that we process has not changed since we began the program." Anecdotally, Ferguson has noticed that the traffic seems to ramp up toward the end of the year as non-commercial traffic increases, with folks going back and forth for the holidays. Other than that, he has few ways of anticipating heavy traffic and advising Presidians to avoid hazards in advance. "It comes and goes in waves," he said. After the mayor's social media post, City Administrator Pablo Rodriguez sprang into action. "There are four lots for transmigrantes outside of city limits, managed by different brokers, essentially truck stops, with places for the drivers to park, shower, and rest before the long journey through Mexico." Rodriguez tracked down as many folks as he could to get the transmigrantes side of the story. A manager at SAD, S-A-D, the largest transmigrante lot in Presidio, could not be reached for comment. Safety was his top priority, not just for the people of Presidio. "The transmigrantes themselves are risking injury," he said, citing a story from one resident about a driver who opened his door past the white line of the shoulder and jumped down to check on something just as another vehicle was blazing past. Rodriguez's next course of action was checking in with Municipal Judge Viviana Cataño to make sure it was legal to start ticketing vehicles on the shoulder for blocking traffic should they linger too long or back up too far. Mayer noted that, at least from the perspective of CBC, the threat of tickets from the local police department prompted drivers to wait until receiving the green light from customs officials. At issue recently was that transmigrantes were lining up early in the morning at the staging point and beyond, he explained. Though the problem seems to have been alleviated with the end of the busy season, both Rodriguez and Ferguson want to make sure similar issues don't crop up again in the future. There's been discussion of lowering the speed limits between the edge of town and the port of entry on U.S. 67, as well as bringing the issue before the city council. "We're going to do what we can for our citizens and for people coming through," Rodriguez said. "Everyone deserves to feel safe when they're traveling through Presidio to Mexico." Big Bend region observes the 109th anniversary of the Battle of Ojinaga. Pancho Villa at the Battle of Ojinaga in a still from the Mutual Film Corporation. By Sam Karras. Ojinaga. The Battle of Ojinaga began 109 years ago this Tuesday, marking another anniversary of the decisive victory of Pancho Villa's revolutionary forces against the Mexican Federal Army, or Federales, in 1914. The battle ended the Federales' stronghold in northern Mexico and pushed many civilians in Chihuahua to flee into the United States, some of whom settled down in the Big Bend region. Echoes of the Mexican Revolution can be felt all over Ojinaga, represented in murals at City Hall in a statue commemorating Villa on the road leading out of town. Many of the city's streets are named for revolutionary leaders, and a detailed exhibit at the Museo Regional de Ojinaga provides a definitive and captivating overview of the conflict for visitors. In late 1913, Pancho Villa, the head of the revolutionary movement in Chihuahua, captured Juarez, then made his way down to Chihuahua City, pushing the Federales out of the capital and toward Ojinaga. Villa sent troops ahead toward the border, who experienced discouraging losses against the 4,500 soldiers awaiting their arrival. On January 10, 1914, the Marfa New Era reported on the first wave of conflict on the outskirts of Ojinaga. An estimated 700 wounded and dying were brought to Presidio for treatment by the Red Cross. The reports from the Associated Dispatches were not exaggerated, according to many eyewitnesses who went from Marfa to see it, the New Era reported. At last September's multicultural festival, the Presidio Convention and Visitors Bureau decided to make an important handoff to the Museo Regional de Ojinaga. The city of Presidio donated a series of panels educating visitors about the Battle of Ojinaga to the museum as a gesture toward how deeply the two cities' histories are intertwined. The panels also detailed an unusual aspect of the Battle of Ojinaga. There was a Hollywood film crew on site to record Villa's victory. On January 5, 1914, the cash-strapped Villa signed a contract with the Mutual Film Company that came with a $25,000 advance. The crew packed their equipment on burros and headed for the border to make a one-of-the-kind film, splicing together live-action footage from the war alongside staged reenactments from Villa's life. As the rebels' second attempt to capture the city began, Marfa resident Tom Turner was one of many locals who hurried south to catch a piece of the action. The Cuero Daily Record reprinted a letter home from Turner on January 13, 1914. "The firing of the artillery and the sharpshooters never did stop," he remembered. "I could not tell how many were killed." Turner did not stay for long on his perch above the river. "There were too many bullets for me," he wrote. The close of the battle and the pre-existing chaos across northern Chihuahua prompted a large caravan of refugees to cross the river and head north. The El Paso Herald reported on January 14th that the surviving Federales, as well as women, children, and livestock, would be staged in Marfa before heading to Fort Bliss via rail. The Herald estimated that there were around 3,700 refugees, which would cost the U.S. government around $1,500 a day to care for. The column of migrants headed to Marfa was rumored to be 12 miles long. The tattered line of former Mexican federal soldiers, women and children, followed by horses, burros, and dogs, as they straggled over the mountain roads in clouds of dust, was a sufficient picture of an army in retreat, they wrote. In A History of Marfa and Presidio County, historian Cecilia Thompson recounted Marfa locals' response to the arrival of the refugees, who were kept in a corral while they waited for the train that would take them to El Paso. The Home Missionary Society, assisted by the Chamber of Commerce, raised $118 in relief funds for the new arrivals. Not everyone was willing to lend a helping hand to the migrants. Marfa State Bank President and Presidio County Commissioner T.M. Wilson felt that the donations might bring on a surge of foreigners and helped put a committee together to appoint additional night watchmen. Other powerful men in the community wired the governor, urging that steps be taken to safeguard Marfa citizens from indigent refugees. Hubbub in Marfa subsided as most of the refugees headed west, but the war would wage on for 5 more years. The Villistas would return to the Big Bend through raids on the Bright Ranch, Glen Springs, and Boquillas. Mysteries surrounding that fateful weekend in 1914 still remain. The original film reels for The Life of General Villa have been lost. American writer and journalist Ambrose Bierce disappeared during the battle. He was most likely killed by crossfire, but no one knows for sure. Those mysteries may never be solved, but Ojinaga marks the anniversary of the battle each year, a reminder of a weekend that left an indelible mark on the history of the city and the history of Mexico.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm recording the Fort Stockton Pioneer newspaper for Thursday, January 12, 2023. Interim police chief appointed by Nathan Heuer. The city of Fort Stockton announced on Tuesday that Ernesto Velasquez has been selected as the interim police chief for the Fort Stockton Police Department with an effective date of January 10th. Velasquez began his tenure with Fort Stockton Police Department as an assistant chief on November 18, 2019, following service in the U.S. Army and as a Texas state trooper. That's very knowledgeable in all aspects of law enforcement, all the way from narcotics to patrol operations and community policing, said Frank Rodriguez, city manager. He knows the operation, the staff, the city. That's a positive aspect for the department. Velasquez takes over the role following Robert Lujan's 39-month stint as police chief. Lujan, who served in law enforcement for the past 33 years, informed the city of his decision to step down on Tuesday. The former police chief quoted Timothy 4:7 when speaking about his departure from the police department. "I have fought the good fight. I finished the race. I have remained faithful." Lujan was hired in October 2019 after he retired from the Texas Department of Public Safety as lieutenant. Rodriguez noted his appreciation for Lujan and his service to the city. His 33 years of experience and his enthusiasm played a vital role in recruiting and developing the police professionals that are patrolling your streets today. He was also instrumental in reorganizing and overseeing the move of the 911 dispatch center from 3rd Street to the current police department. Moving forward, Rodriguez expressed his confidence in Velasquez, stating that he will retain the police chief position for the foreseeable future. "Based on what he's done in the past," meaning assistant chief, "he's been on point. He's been engaged and involved. In other words, I feel very confident in him assuming the role and continuing to improve the department." Velasquez and Rodriguez's analysis of the department will play a large role in how the Fort Stockton Police Department evolves in the future. The city manager mentioned the likelihood of hiring an assistant chief under Velasquez in the near future. "That will be something down the road. It's all evolving in terms of what does he need or want to do. How is everything going to unfold? Historically, we've always gone with the lead of what the department was wanting. For the size of the department, which is not a lot of officers, but the size of the community and the crime rate, we need administrators that can handle different facets of the police department." Chief Velasquez's law enforcement experience and career began as a state trooper, where he worked his way up to the rank of narcotics sergeant and DEA task force officer while assigned to the Texas DPS. Velasquez has an extensive background in short and long-term criminal investigations. He led multi-agency investigations by developing working relationships with local, state, and federal agencies. He also served as the investigator for the Pecos County Attorney's Office. He attended Texas State University in San Marcos and studied criminal justice. He is a veteran of the United States Army, where he served as an Army Ranger and assigned to the 75th Ranger Regiment and United States Special Operations Command. City approves cemetery jake-breaking ordinances by Sean Yorks. Fort Stockton, at its January 9th, 2023 meeting, passed an ordinance that will now allow more bodies to be buried per individual grave or plot at East Hill Cemetery. Ordinance 23-100 amends Chapter 7 of the Code of Ordinances, East Hill Cemetery, to allow for two bodies or four cremains to be buried at each plot. You have to get consent of all the owners of each plot, said City Attorney Puha Bonpale. Mayor Chris Alexander questioned how that would be possible, and Interim Police Chief Ernesto Velasquez, who was in the audience, explained that one of his family members is buried in the same plot with his sons on top of him. I had asked this to be researched because of the cremated remains. Our current ordinance is you only had one per a whole plot. That doesn't make sense. The state of Texas allows more. Following the passage of the ordinance, the council considered which amended Chapter 23 of the Code of Ordinances, specifically jake breaking or engine breaking of semis. Jake or engine braking is compression-released engine braking, releasing the compressed air in the engine through the exhaust valves to reduce speed, which causes a loud noise. I was asked to draft this because I guess the 18-wheelers have what's called a jake brake, and it makes a lot of noise that the residents can hear from the highway. This is an ordinance to put up signs on the highway that it's a violation to use unless it's an emergency. Before the ordinance was approved, Ruben Falcon said that most of the time such signs are in towns and asked where the signs in Fort Stockton would be placed. It's recommended we'll have to get with TxDOT and those signs will be placed in the area that they designate. We'll be coming off the interstate, Rodriguez said. Falcon said he normally hears the engine braking at the park when 18-wheelers are coming in from the border. Any TxDOT highway that the city wants to identify for this ordinance will have to get permission. The ordinance was unanimously approved. County approves purchase of canine for the sheriff's office. With a mutual aid agreement now in place between Pecos and Terrell counties to assist with the influx of illegal migrants crossing into Terrell County, Pecos County took defense of the border a step further at the commissioner's meeting. The court approved the purchase of a canine narcotics officer that will be used on patrols in both counties as part of the mutual aid agreement. The purchase was made possible by a donation of $9,300 from Eagle Claw Midstream. The donation will also be used to purchase ammunition. The canine will be used in the east end of the county, Sheffield and Iran. We're having so much to deal with in Terrell County with all these immigrants coming up, said Sheriff T.J. Perkins. It'll be good use to have a drug dog there catching the drugs coming there also. County Judge Joe Schuster asked if the other canine officer was retiring, and the sheriff said it was too old, adding that the new animal has already been trained, so it has to be pretty young. The commission also approved the purchase of ammunition with part of the donation. In other action, the commissioner's court approved mileage reimbursement for county employees of 65.5 cents per mile, which is the federal rate. The county approved the purchase of the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Building on Airport Drive. Texas A&M has been wanting to sell the building, but Schuster said that according to the airport deed restrictions, the federal government gave the building to Pecos County as a gift, and the deed said all of the property is to stay together and cannot be sold. It can be leased for a period of time, but it cannot be sold. The commissioner's court in 1992, working with A&M Extension, were in a hot battle with Reeves County to have the extension taken from Fort Stockton. In haste, they agreed to sell them that acreage without researching it. I don't know how that got done. The only entity that the university could sell the building to was the county. Texas A&M had the property evaluated, and it's worth between $2 and $2.5 million. Schuster spoke with the university, which agreed to $750,000. They want to continue to lease a couple of the offices out there, so we're going to have to figure out a rental. The court agreed to purchase the building at that price, and we'll have to declare an emergency, and we'll have to amend the budget to purchase the building at the next meeting.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, January 5th. Arson charges filed after officials say accelerant used in Bruce Street fire Monday. Home demoed on Wednesday. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A short time after firefighters were called to a burning house at 1003 South Bruce Street on Monday, homeowner Johanna Gray was arrested on second-degree felony arson charges after fire officials said an accelerant was used near the condemned home. This is the third time members of the Monahans Fire Department have been called to the house regarding a major fire. Quote, We've been called there several times for small fires, but this was at least the third time for a large fire, which threatened neighboring properties and residents, Monahan's Volunteer Fire Department Chief Randy Crabtree said. Officers were called to the home around 9:45 p.m. on Monday, January 2nd, after what was left of the condemned home was engulfed in flames. When officers arrived, Gray was seen attempting to put out the large fire with a water hose. Quote, "Once responding officers were able to get the owner away from the home, officers began to question how the fire began, but Gray wouldn't say exactly how this fire started," Monahan's Police Department Captain Stormy Law said. Crabtree added, quote, "It was clear some sort of accelerant was used because there was an area between the home and the travel trailer we kept spraying with water and it would just flame right back up," end quote. At that point, Gray was placed in cuffs and taken into custody at the Ward County Jail. Quote, "The home was within 4 feet of other residences, which indicates threat to life or personal property," Laws added. Firefighters had to take down a wall on the south side of the home, which landed on the neighbor's fence, but no other damage to neighboring properties was reported. Gray was also charged with interfering with public duties, a Class B misdemeanor. The home first caught fire in May 2021. Fire officials said at the time, quote, "The fire was believed to have begun in the kitchen by the back door. The fire was so hot that it broke every window in the house and the roof collapsed. Flames were coming out in all directions and consumed the whole home quickly," end quote. Gray's family members believed she was still in the home, but shortly after firefighters arrived, they learned the home was in fact empty. A neighbor's home to the north lost part of their fence and a few trees on the property, but their home did not suffer any damage. Since the fire in May, Gray has been staying on the property in an RV travel trailer, which fire officials were called out to in July after clothes in the RV caught fire. Gray was able to extinguish the small fire before firefighters arrived, and there was minimal damage to the RV as a result of the fire. During the November 26th City Council meeting, council members determined the home was unsafe and may not be feasibly repaired, and Gray was given 10 days to clear everything out of the home and off the property and to demolish the structure. Because Gray didn't comply with the court order, the city will step in and demolish and obtain a lien on the property for the cost of the demolition. Quote, "The city has scheduled the cleanup of the property to begin Wednesday. The owner stays in an RV on site with electricity, water, and sewer, which the city will leave. A wall of the small garage provides part of the fence, therefore is not part of the legally condemned property and will not be torn down. There is a small chance the cleanup could be postponed due to legal or logistical issues. The city will kennel any legally owned animals for the owner until such time as the owner can provide adequate shelter for the animal or animals," City Manager Rex Thee said. Owner of the neighboring property, Don Hubbard, said, quote, "He was glad the city was finally taking action on the property," end quote. If convicted, Gray could face a prison sentence of 2 to 20 years in prison and a fine up to $10,000. She is also facing prison time after being indicted in August on charges of driving while intoxicated for a third time, a third-degree felony. The case has yet to go to trial. Gray currently remains in jail in lieu of posting the $26,500 bond. New elementary celebrates opening. Students to begin classes Thursday. The story was written by Jan Crenfield. Parkway Elementary held a grand opening on Wednesday, January 4th. The public was invited to come tour the new school during a teacher's workday. 3rd through 6th grades will report to classes at the new school building at 8 a.m. on Thursday morning. Parents can learn about student drop-off and pickup by going to district website at mwpisd.esc18.net or going to the Parkway Elementary office to pick up a hard copy of the map or check the Parent Remind app on their phones. The new school has a student capacity of 900, split into two wings, one wing dedicated to third and fourth grades, and one dedicated to fifth and sixth grades, as well as two gyms, separate cafeterias and playgrounds, one library, one bus drop-off, and two parent drop-off drives. Quote, "The school is ready for students to start learning. We just have a few minor things that need to be tweaked, like a possible card reader on a door or machine, and there's still finished work on the grounds, but that will not interfere with the classes," Monahan's Wicked Pyote ISD Superintendent Chad Smith said. The new school is part of the $140 million bond passed in May 2019. Bonds are sold to provide funding for capital improvements that last for a number of years. Just as an individual agrees to repay a new home loan, voters authorize the district to sell and repay bonds for making major capital improvements. School boards can only levy interest and sinking taxes, a savings account that, in most instances, requires monthly deposits to be set aside only for payment of debt service, principal, and interest, in the amount necessary to repay the bonds. If the amount needed to pay the bonds is less, the district taxes less. At the time of the bond proposal, a 21-member community focus committee prioritized the district's needs as follows: 1. Safety and security of students and staff; 2. Potential growth due to economic dynamics; 3. Modernization of classroom space; and 4. Address aging facilities. Along with the new elementary for grades 3 through 6, Phase 1 upgrades for Cullender and Tatum included front entrance upgrades, safety and security upgrades, interior paint and flooring, exterior finishes, restroom repairs and upgrades, roof and climate control replacements, electrical upgrades, accessibility improvements, new playgrounds, exterior doors, energy-efficient windows, and sidewalk replacements. As well, a new parking lot and exterior awning at Cullender, and a new bus drive with shade canopy and cafeteria sound system at Tatum. All of Phase 1 upgrades have been completed for both schools. Phase 2 is the remodeling of classrooms, which is scheduled to begin as soon as school is out this coming summer. The high school transformation that was proposed by the bond committee was to include replacing or remodeling every building over 50 years old. Also in the bond proposal for high school were new flooring, ceilings, exterior doors, energy-efficient windows and parking lot asphalt, as well as a new gym, practice gym, natatorium, baseball field, softball field, track, and band marching pad. To be completed as soon as possible is the roof and proper rain gutters over the old breezeway between the main building and the band hall, as well as the wall to close the east end of the old breezeway. This will completely close in the whole building under one roof. Quote, "Students will not have to go outside to get to any part of the high school," Smith said. The cafeteria and kitchen will be completed and in use by the end of January or 1st of February, Smith said. Quote, "The holdup on the cafeteria and kitchen was the addition of an electrical hub room for all of the surrounding electrical outlets needed for all the appliances," Smith said. "The parking lot is in use now, as well as the high school front entry. The front entryway is the only entrance into the high school, as all others have been closed. The baseball field locker rooms, concession stand, and press box will be finished possibly by the end of February. The new track will be started as soon as the current track season is over. The new tennis courts are finished, but are waiting on the delivery of the stadium seats for spectators. The natatorium has a probable finish deadline of the end of March," he said. Football field houses, high school and junior high, will be ready by the end of August. The football field concession is waiting on doors to be delivered, as well as several handrails for the outdoor and indoor stadium bleacher seating. The press box will be ready by the end of school, along with the elevator to the press box. Quote, the Walker Junior High Fieldhouse will become a renovated fieldhouse for our track and tennis athletes and will be used for visiting sports teams, Smith said. The new auditorium, which seats 700, is in use with finished dressing rooms, scene storage, lighting, sound system, choir room, and black box theater, a separate theater room for use during UIL events. The existing special education building is to be removed and relocated to a remodeled section of Sugarth, and a parking lot will replace the building at the current location, Smith said. Monahan's Education Center will undergo remodeling this summer, converting it into a testing center, as well as classrooms with four large computer labs and a multi-purpose conference room, as well as added security entry, electronic lock-in classroom doors, video cameras, and other safety upgrades. The competition gym and the practice gym will be built on the current natatorium location as soon as the new 500-seat natatorium is completed this spring. Upgrades to the Jerry Larned Sports Complex will involve only the entry lobby area of the complex. Renovation of the restrooms and concession area is the core of that project. A state-of-the-art career and technology center will be housed in a converted Sudirth Elementary. Career expansion courses are to include nursing, culinary arts, robotics, cosmetology, fashion, and computer technology. Welding and auto tech will also be located at the Sudirth site. The Monahans Education Center will remain where it is, but will share its facility with rooms for a testing center and a conference meeting place. At Walker Junior High, all renovations are complete, including upgrades to the auditorium, library, front office and administration area, locker room, restrooms, and safety and security upgrades. Quote, there's been some unexpected problems, but they have been dealt with, and we are on the downhill side of the whole project. The Monahans School District will have some of the finest state-of-the-art campuses in the state, Smith said. Police arrest wrong-way driver New Year's morning. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A 26-year-old Monahans man was arrested shortly after midnight on January 1st after officers observed him driving on the wrong side of the road. Monahans Police Department Captain Stormy Laws said he saw the suspect, Guadalupe Jose Marquez, age 26, of 801 South Leon Street, stopped on the wrong side of the road on North Allen Street around 12:23 a.m. on New Year's Day. Quote, once I got behind Marquez, he started east into the 200 block of East A Street and continued to travel on the wrong side of the road, Laws said. Laws conducted a felony stop, and during the course of the investigation, 13.4 grams of suspected cocaine was located inside the vehicle. Marquez was subsequently taken into custody at the Ward County Jail and charged with driving while intoxicated, a Class A misdemeanor, and possession of a controlled substance penalty group 1, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams, a second-degree felony. Bond was set at $15,000 for the drug charge and $1,500 for the DWI charge. Marquez posted the bonds and was released. If convicted, Marquez could face 2 to 20 years in prison and a fine up to $10,000 if convicted. Romo and Bean take oath of office, begin terms. Uncontested officials also sworn in. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Newly elected officials gathered at the Ward County Courthouse on Sunday, January 1st, to be sworn into office. 7 newly elected officials participated in the ceremony, including those who won uncontested races. Sunday's ceremony took place before a courtroom packed with supporters and family members. It opened with a few remarks from Ward County Judge Greg Holly, who was the first to take his oath of office before the assembled audience. The locally contested races for the March 1, 2022 primary drew over 2,000 voters to the polls as Valerie Romo, Larry Hanna, Danny Bustos, and Roy Bean came away victorious. The voter turnout of 2012 ballots represents 29% of the 6,800 registered voters in Ward County. In the race for 143rd Judicial District Clerk of Ward County, Valerie Romo outdistanced Tommy Lujan by a count of 1,046, or 58%, to 730. Republican incumbent Precinct 2 Commissioner Larry Hanna was successful in his re-election bid, topping challenger Joel Greiner. Hanna received 448 votes, or 65%, to 238 for Greiner. The race for Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 and 4 between incumbent Republican Danny Bustos and challenger Dolores Navarrete, Bustos received 58% of the ballots, 378, to 265 for Navarrete. Bustos has held the position since 2019 when he defeated longtime JP Pascual Olivas. Navarrete is the former chief deputy for Olivas. Local businessman Roy Bean topped Elizabeth Morales with a vote count of 812, or 69%, to 358 for Morales. Incumbent JP Elizabeth Polanco did not run for re-election. Bean is a longtime Monahans businessman and is a captain on the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department. Since there was not a Democratic candidate for any of the listed above races, all were determined elected during the November midterm election. Along with Holly, Ward County Clerk Denise Valle was sworn into office, as was Ward County Treasurer Carly Ennis and Ward County Commissioner Precinct 4 Eddie Nelms.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.